Chapter 45. Home, home, I'm deranged. In the end, it was the radical alum who saved me. It was he who pulled the police off Joey Kay's trail and set them onto Hugh Blackwell's. He did so after another run-in with Blackwell at the Columbia Club. When they encountered each other in the lion's den, the radical alum behaved like he usually did, like the proverbial gadfly, swooping in to take nips out of the old lion's hide for his political views and his questionable business ethics. In the normal course, Blackwell would have responded with open hostility and contempt. Not this time. In fact, this time he barely responded at all. He just sat there in the wing chair before the fire, listless and subdued. A worn-out old lion as decrepit as the stuffed and mounted one lurking behind the display cases. That is, until the radical alum happened to bring up my name, asking if Blackwell had managed to corrupt me yet. That's when the old lion's behavior underwent a seismic shift. He abruptly stood up out of his chair, left the lion's den by the tapestry exit, and quickly departed for his limo. It was this behavior that initially aroused the radical alum's suspicions. Reconstructing all this afterwards, this meeting must have taken place when Blackwell had gone to the Columbia Club to wrestle with his conscience. That is, after he had left me stewing in the vat, but before he had returned the second time to switch on the CO2 bubbler. Even though his suspicions had been aroused, the radical alum did nothing about it, not immediately. But later, when word began to spread that I was missing, it caused him to become concerned enough that he called the police himself. He spoke with Detective Lippincott, who, in her escalating unease, contacted my Uncle Frank. He, in turn, got in touch with Aunt Ruth, who then contacted Lonnie Kim, resulting in them all making a mad dash for Manhattan. Aunt Ruth and Lonnie Kim, of course, were last to arrive, but my Uncle Frank managed to reach Manhattan by helicopter in less than 90 minutes. The result of all this was that Detective Lippincott, the radical alum, and my Uncle Frank were all at the door of Blackwell's penthouse when he happened to show up, and where they happened to notice the fresh cola stains on his button-down Oxford cloth. It was the radical alum who happened to be the one familiar enough with Blackwell's business holdings that he was able to make the intuitive connection between cola stains and Blackwell's ownership of the OK Cola bottling plant on the northern tip of Manhattan. Knowledge of which resulted in a screaming caravan of police cars rendezvousing outside the bottling plant, where I was discovered to be, remarkably, still among the living. My first few days in the hospital were not pleasant. Not only was I in physical pain, but I was a mental basket case as well. I'm sure, were it not for my damaged skin's susceptibility to infection, which forced me to remain in intensive care, I would have been transferred to a psychiatric wing. Concerning my immersion in the exfoliating bath, doctors estimated I had nearly passed the point of no return. In campfire parlance, I was like a marshmallow that was just starting to brown. A very little longer, and I would have been forever scarred. As it was, except for a few minor skin grafts, which would heal without scarring, I was left with nothing but baby soft skin. Were it not for the pain involved, I'm certain there would be a place for phys vats in beauty parlors all across the country. However, that medical assessment applied only to the 90% of me that was below the surface of the mildly carbonated cola. The parts above were a different story. The leaping bubbles had irritated my nasal passages, the roof of my mouth, my lips, and my lungs. My corneas were scratched too, accounting for the halo effect I saw around every face as I was being pulled out of the vat, an effect that didn't go away completely for several weeks. Like a cornea transplant patient, I had to wear sunglasses or else remain in a darkened room. My eardrums were similarly affected. It was as if I had tinnitus. I kept hearing that fizzing sound all the time, even in my sleep, especially in my sleep. Following my transfer out of intensive care, Lonnie Kim and Aunt Ruth took turns watching over me round the clock. My first night on the step-down floor, I had a particularly bad episode, triggered by the click of Aunt Ruth's knitting needles, which I mistook in my delirium for my Morse code tapping inside the vat. It set off a nightmare flashback out of which I had to be sedated. With continued rest, however, I recovered a little more each day. Aunt Ruth didn't lecture me once, a Herculean feat on her part. I also caught her a number of times dabbing at her nose and the corners of her eyes with her handkerchief. The attending doctors informed me that not only was I fortunate I got pulled out of the acid bath when I did, but I was also lucky that my time in Joey's car trunk had not lasted any longer than it had. Otherwise, I would have been beyond resuscitation there as well. Once removed from intensive care, doctors began allowing me visitors. Uncle Frank brought with him Detective Lippincott. The two of them filled me in on everything that had taken place outside the vat, but I could tell by their hesitancy that the doctors had warned them not to inquire about anything that had gone on inside the vat.